Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Super Rocking Supertone Show. Of course, Led Zeppelin, Communication Breakdown, from their 1969 debut album Led Zeppelin, released on the 12th of January 1969 on the Atlantic Record label, and in my opinion, one of the greatest rock and roll albums ever made.
Isn't that funny?
What's funny?
Well, I was reading about it. It took a little while for people to really appreciate the first Led Zeppelin album because some people didn't think it was as good as... I don't know.
What, the Yardbirds? And
I don't know. I just find it, I think it's bloody brilliant, excuse my French. That's not swearing.
No, it's not. And, you know, the great thing about Led Zeppelin 1, because I'm just reading the Jimmy Page book at the moment, and it's, I've got to say, as it goes on, the sadder it becomes, and the sadder I become about Jimmy Page, because I've had a lot of affinity with him over the years, musically, you know, and I'm born on the same date in January as him, you know. And it you know, it saddened me. But when you listen to the fresh excitement of that, and Robert Plant screaming his ghoulies off, and, you know, and John Paul Jones on that with a ferocious bass line, Bonzo Bonham beating the crap out of those drums. But behind it all is a magnificent production and recording. Magnificent. Jimmy Page... When he was at this time, he'd just finished all his session work. He'd been working with the Yardbirds. And he was starting towards the, you know, the peak of his power. It was like over the next 4 years, really, where he was really peaking. And it was unbelievable. You listen to that stereo mix, which was still relatively new, you know, and Left and Right, there was on one side there was like one guitar, one's cleaner on the other side, and the right hand side you hear, and then you got that overdub, you know, which it sort of jumps out at you. And produced, engineered by Glyn Johns at Olympic.
Oh, mate, Glyn.
Yeah, and the first time he'd ever used his Glyn Johns technique, which was completely by accident, because they were in such a rush, what happened is that They were recording acoustic guitars. I think they were doing Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You. And Jimmy Page said, right, we need to set the drums up. And Glyn Johns just whipped some microphones across and stuck them around John Bonham's drums in a very unusual way, an overhead, one to the sort of right of the floor tom and then one in front of the kick drum. And he just put the faders up and he said it sounded amazing.
Yeah.
And in his book, Glyn Johns' book, he said it was the easiest session he ever had to do because all he did, he just literally stuck the mics in front of everything and turned the faders up. And he said, yeah, that's what it sounded like. We'll be right back.
Steve Hillage and Hurdy Gurdy Man from the second studio album called L, and that was released in 1976 on Virgin Records.
Well then, Steve Hillage.
Yes, who is Steve Hillage?
Well, he was a member of the mighty Gong. And that really says it all. You know, the guys that invented their own language.
Gong.
And they're all living on the planet Gong. They came from the planet Gong.
Gong.
We've had Gong on before. Great band. But Steve Hillage was a bit of a shock to me. He was a bit of an inspiration because what happened is that Deeply Veiled Festival, we played there twice as Whitefire when I was first kicking off, because this was released in 76. So I was just sort of playing guitar, sort of kind of full time then. And you know, 75, 76. And we supported Steve Hillage. Now, there's a lot of conjecture over this. And Chris Hewitt, who actually used to run it, says we didn't. But I know, because I can remember being there and playing. There was us, then Victor Brox, and then it was Steve Hillage, I remember. Anyway, that's a whole new story. But I bought the record because I'd never really heard him as a solo artist yet. And I bought L, and I freaked out. I thought it was fantastic, you know. His guitar playing was great. And then all of a sudden, right, I hear Crying to the Sky, Bill Nelson and Bebop Deluxe. And there's a lot of that sound in there, that like swirly, phasey sort of guitar sound. A lot of the lines as well, pretty Bill Nelson. So I'm just trying to find out who's come first. I'm furiously looking at
you?
Now.
I wonder what you're up to.
Yeah, and the other thing is that Eric Johnson, who came later, of course, the great American guitar player, he sounds very suspiciously like Steve Hillage. So I think there's a little bit of Hillage plagiarismiting going on. Anyway.
Well, that was recorded at a place called The Secret Sound in Woodstock in New York. Now, I love the sound of Woodstock. I love Woodstock. I think most people do, really. And it was produced and engineered by a chap called Todd Rundgren,
yes,
who used to be in a band called Utopia.
Indeed.
So, but anyway, so this version spent 12 weeks in the UK album charts, peaked at number 10 with his album, L. And also, what I didn't realise, obviously, we all know it was written by Donovan. Well, if you don't, you do now. And who's a Scottish singer-songwriter. I actually saw Donovan when I went to the Green Man Festival, like, yonkers ago. And
Yonkers?
Yeah.
That's a place in
It's
New
a
York.
Herefordshire term.
Yeah. Okay, right, okay.
And it was funny, though, because I wasn't around at the time. He just basically name-dropped all through the gig, and he was just a bit annoying. And I really didn't want to feel like that, but he just got worn down by, oh, yeah. But anyway, apparently this, but you can see it now, because apparently he wrote this song when he was in Rishikesh in India, where he was studying transcendental meditation with the Beatles.
Mm.
And George Harrison apparently helped him write the lyrics. And so he was hanging out with all that set. It's just a bit weird. You know, when you haven't really kind of heard of someone as much as you have as all these other well-known people.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was written by... I actually prefer Steve Hillage's version, got to say. I think it's far more interesting, and it started to make me feel like I'd had a glass of wine.
Well, it's definitely a lot of whittering guitar,
yeah.
and Todd Rundgren again. I think he did a really good job on that record. And of course, Sunset is it Sunset Studios?
The Secret Sound.
Secret Sound. Sorry, yeah. That became Utopia later on in Woodstock, and I think it's his studio. I think it's his private studio, which he recorded a lot of stuff. Not a lot about it, but it's one of those. It's certainly a track of its time.
Yeah.
And bearing in mind, this very year, punk came out, sort of thing. Punk really hit the UK.
Yeah.
Led Zeppelin next year in 77, we're going to play Nebworth. That you know, the concert where they were all dinosaurs and, you know, punk had just taken over.
Yeah.
And I've just looked up now, and Sunburst Finish with Bill Nelson was released in 1976, the same year, in February. So I don't know who came first, and I don't know who'd been watching who live, but something's gone on.
Takes a cigarette, puts it in your mouth. You pull on your finger, then another finger, then cigarette. The water wall is calling, it lingers, then you forget. Oh, 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 you're a rock and roll suicide. You're too old to lose it, too young to choose it. And the clock waits so patiently on your song. You walk past the cafe, but you don't eat when you've lived too long. Oh no, 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 you're a rock and roll suicide. Shift break for snarling as you stumble across the road. But the day breaks instead, so you hurry home. Don't let the sun blast your shadow. Don't let the milk float rob your mind. They're so natural, religiously unkind. Oh no, love, you're not alone. You're watching yourself, but you're too unfair.
David Bowie, Rock and Roll Suicide, originally released as the closing track on his fifth studio album, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, on the 16th of June 1972 on the RCA record label. That was a bit of a mouthful.
Yeah, I was really proud of you then. I think you got through it really well. But it was also released, this is another thing, it was also released as a single in April 1974. And what it was is that RCA were impatient for new material. They'd already rush-released Rebel Rebel from Diamond Dog Sessions, and they just arbitrarily picked Rock and Roll Suicide as his next single. The problem was, it was 2 years old. Most of the fans had already got it on the album, and they just saw it as a money-making exercise. So it only got to number 22 of the charts. It was his first single not to get into the top 20 because they cocked it up, basically.
Well, so
shame on them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, there you go. What a song, though. I can't believe just how many different textures David Bowie keeps revealing in all his music. I mean, when that brass comes in, it's beautiful.
Well, I think Ronno arranged all that.
Well, I was thinking about Ronno, actually, because there was some beautiful colour in it.
Well, that's right. I think a runner-up, because this was produced and engineered by Ken Scott. Not one of our favourite producers, not because of the sound. It's just he seems a bit...
It's a bit cocky.
Yeah, a bit cocky. Having said that, I suppose if you are Ken Scott, you work with the Beatles, you work with a lot of other people.
I think sometimes it's just the fact that he chews gum when he talks and it just comes across a little bit wrong.
He did a great job on this, a great drum sound. But that last chord, of course, on the, cellos, is straight at the Beatles. And you're thinking, oh, baby, you can hear that. You can hear, they've just taken that off the turntable. Think, well, stick that on the end, I think, Ronno. But this was the Spiders from Mars band. You can hear Ronson's, a.k.a. Ronno, guitar at the end, beautiful. Woody Woodmansey on drums, Trevor Boulder on bass. It's the classic, the classic.
It is classic, but it's just really weird. Can I just tell you something really weird that just happened? Right, you know, I'd made the notes to this song. Well, when I was listening to it then, what really struck me, and I've written it down, when he sings, "Oh no, love, you're not alone." And I just thought, that's really, "Oh no, love, you're not alone." It's like, what a weird, beautiful, to call someone love. And then I've just looked at my notes, and that was a reference to Jacques Brel's song, "You're Not Alone, Jeff."
Is that right?
Yeah, and it appeared in the musical Jacques Brel Is Alive and Well and Living in Paris.
Well, Jacques Brel, I mean, he was, you know, he completely influenced so many musicians, didn't he?
Scott Walker.
Yeah, that's right.
David Bowie.
I think we need some more Scott Walker. We'll have him on for a bit.
Next.
Yes, next.
We love that. Honestly, though, it's just, I want to listen to more of this. But when I read about this whole album as well, it was a loose concept album, and I love the description. It's about a fictional, androgynous, bisexual rock star who acts as a messenger for extraterrestrial beings. Joy, Division, and Love Will Tear Us Apart, released as a single in June 1980 on the very famous Factory Records. Mm.
There we are. Well, we've played Joy Division before. We've had Transmission on, you know, and a couple of other tracks, I think. Love Joy Division. You know, Bernard Sumner can't sing. He can't play guitar. The band are an absolute nightmare. Hookie, the bass player, Peter Hook, who I do know, even though he's a little bit clunky, he really did form the sound of Joy Division and later on New Order, you know, because it's that bass thing. And we saw him on that bass program with Tina Weymouth the other night on the BBC.
Yeah.
And he was talking about how he actually just followed on the bass the vocal line. And he said, and that's what this song's all about. And it's true, actually, if you listen to it, you know.
Yeah.
Because he plays right up the neck, and he is the lead instrument in this band, you know. Everything else is pads and the drums, which are always very awkward and stuff, you know. Everybody's awkward. But Hookie's got that sort of swagger about him, with his bass around his kneecap somewhere. It's so low, you know.
That's why he has to play it up the neck.
Yeah. You know, I never thought about that. That's probably why.
Well, I remember he's always like... as if he slipped on some margarine on the floor and he can't quite stand up right.
True.
He's also like, oh, quick, up the neck, quick, dusty end, not so dusty now. But what I did realise, and this is lovely when I read this, okay. Well, so they'd actually recorded Love Will Tear Us Apart at a place called Pennine Studios in Oldham on the 8th of January 1980, along with the B-side, These Days.
I have recorded that. At the Pennine with White Fire. Anyway, carry on. They had a big old Trident TSM desk in there.
This is what I want you to talk about, because you're part of this scene.
Oh yeah. Well, but the Pennine in Oldham, I've got a picture. I'm looking very chubby on it, actually, with a Berman amp in the studio there with White Fire. Yes, so there. And then, where did they record the next?
Well, exactly. Well,
carry on.
Strawberry Studios, because they didn't like the results. So producer Martin Hannett got the band to reconvene at Strawberry Studios in Stockport in March to re-record it.
Through the Helios desk.
Exactly.
Oh, it was beautiful studio, Strawberry. I worked an awful lot in Strawberry. It was great, great place, you know. But I never met Martin Hanna, actually, but the rest of the band, I did. But it's very cool, and the whole story, and they're very much part of the Manchester scene, aren't they? Yeah. I'm sorry for cutting across you. I'm very enthusiastic
I'm just looking
about this.
You know? No, I want you to tell your stories. You're part of it, for goodness sake. It's like you're part of the Manchester scene. And what inspires me is that you've got real life experience stories to tell me and to share with our mates, you know? It's just great. I love it.
Yeah, but the whole scene then, you know, it was really quite cool. Manchester's always been a pretty cool place for music, you know, but I think this particular period was really, it was all going off, you know. I mean, there was loads of stuff happening, you know, new wave, because of course Elvis Costello was around, and all the Manchester bands, you know, and then 808 State. Kicked off later on with all the dance stuff. It was amazing, amazing time.
I mean, it's actually just thinking about it those days, actually getting into a recording studio. I mean, just to be a part of that, you know, it's something that you dream about as a kid, really. So, you know, brilliant, brilliant, blinking well done, you.
To dance, he had a face like a mask. Somebody said from the Bible he'd quote, there was dust on the man in the long black coat. There's a sermon he gave. He said every man's conscience is vile and depraved. You cannot depend on it to be your guide when it's you who must keep it satisfied. It ain't easy to swallow. It sticks in the throat to give her heart to the man in a long black coat. There are no mistakes in life, some people say, and it's true sometimes, you can see it that way. But people don't live or die, people just float. She went with the man in a long black coat. There's smoke on the water, it's up in there since June. Tree trunks uprooted neath the high crescent moon. Feel the pulse and vibration and the rumbling fuss. Somebody is out there beating on a dead horse. She never said nothing, there was nothing she wrote. She'd gone with a man in a long black coat.
Man in the long black coat from his 26th, yes, 26th, folks, studio album, Oh Mercy, which was released on September 18th, 1989 on Columbia Records.
And produced by...
my favourite producer of all time, Daniel Lanois. And hardly surprised he's my favourite producer. That is nothing short of magnificent. I talked about Jimmy Page producing before, you know. We've talked about Ken Scott, you know, both beautiful and you know, with great artists. But this record is one of my go-to records. If and you know this, if I'm going to do a mix, I always put on this first because then I realise what excellence I'm aiming to achieve.
Exactly. Crickets are chirping.
Some of them, they're beating on a dead horse.
What it's really dark.
Oh, man, it's great. And the thing is, this is part, and I know I talk about this, if you listen to the show a lot, you'll know I talk about Lanois, you know, wistfully and beautifully.
We should go out for a beer with Daniel, actually.
We do need to. We need to meet him, definitely. Yeah. Because this was the part of the trilogy of albums he did that were recorded at this blasted bungalow. Where was it, darling?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I found out the address the other day. It's 1305 Sonyat Street at the corner of Perrier Street in the uptown district of New Orleans, baby.
So he basically, he did this in this kitchen, in a kitchen.
He rented a house and Mark Howard came along and he was his studio installer and he basically bought all his kit and set it all up. And he set up a recording studio in a house.
And Mark Howard, we know, he's a friend of mine on Facebook. Yeah. And also co-produced by...
Malcolm Byrne.
Yeah, another mate of ours, which we spoke to. Great, great guy. And Malcolm, actually, has just got a show now on Mixcloud.
Yeah.
And the other day, and he liked our show, and I think he listens to it. So that's all very cool. Yeah, you know, we feel very honoured. Malcolm Byrne, but he played tambourine on this.
He did. And keyboards.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was listening out for it, actually. Well, that's funny, isn't it? Sado.
And Lanois on the guitar, in great atmosphere.
Do you know...
The lyric, the vocal pattern, the vocal tone, and the picture of him sat on a seat. This is Bob Dylan in this bungalow in New Orleans, and he sat there with a normal dynamic mind. I think, it's a Bayer, I think, M88. It's just like, and he's singing into it.
Yeah. But the thing is, you see, I don't... Bob Dylan's Bob Dylan. He's a bloke. He just happens to be really good at what he does. And some people don't like him. And some people will discover him later on, you know, in their lives. It all depends. And I just wonder, you know, how... The bit that I've read with Dan and Lamar when he was recording with Bob, that he was actually, you know, I think you've got to be really good with people, because I think Bob's quite a private guy and he comes in and he just does his thing, and you've got to really, you can't be inside his head. You've got to be where, you can't be hassling him, can you?
No, you can't. But, you know, I think Lamar clearly has, because he's worked with you too, he's worked with Peter Gabriel, so many people of completely different, works a lot with Brian Eno, completely different mixtures of people, you know.
Yeah.
But with these three albums, with the Neville Brothers, Yellow Moon, his own Acadie record, and this one, Oh Mercy, you know, he captured that sound of New Orleans. He captured that deep south thing. And I know for a fact he used a lot of those musicians, you know, around. And it has that sort of swampy sound, doesn't it?
And he was keeping it real, and he was riding his motorbike a lot as well. So I think that's always good, just to be a part of a neighbourhood as well.
Yeah. Great stuff.
The Ting Tings and Shut Up and Let Me Go, which was their fourth single from their debut studio album, We Started Nothing, which went to number one in the UK album charts, you know. And it was released in the UK on the 21st of July and the 8th of August in the rest of Europe in 2008 on Columbia Records.
Well, we have an affinity with Salford, don't we? Us
it's
both
weird,
being graduates at different levels, of course.
In different courses
from Salford University.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And, it's weird that, isn't it?
Yeah. And Starlight, the super SWAT, got a first. And I just scraped out with a basic sort of degree because I was playing rock and roll. I wasn't doing any lectures.
You were actually, I got, it was a media and performance one. I got first and my second degree, so I went back and did a different one.
Oh, God, second degree.
Didn't want to sort of brag or anything, but
yeah. Yeah, I know.
But the thing with the Salford scene, which is really weird, so I was up there in 1990, and I didn't even know that Coronation Street was filmed in Manchester. I was from Herefordshire. I'd lived in London, you know. I was just travelling around, you know, trying to find my you know, the calling as of an artist. Mm. Sometimes you've got to try different things and live in different areas. And what I loved about Manchester was and Salford was that it gave me like tapas. I did this course where you could do a bit of radio. I even did some contemporary dance. Was really bad at it, by the way. But just did a tapas of things. But the thing with the whole Salford thing and the whole Manchester thing, it was vibrant and fresh, and it was rough, and it was really tough. Actually, I kid you not. And it was very much a bloke scene when I was up there. But later on, what was interesting is that I had a house just on the corner, just round the corner from a place called Islington Mill.
Okay.
And this is where the Ting Tings started taking off, because Katie White, they're a duo, basically. Jules DeMartino, it's funny names.
Blimey.
I know. But they met, and anyway, he relocated up to Manchester, and he ended up working as a producer at Islington Mill round the corner, and Katie worked behind the bar, and they were working on various bands. And basically what they did, they decided to form a band together, influenced by all the other bands that they were working with.
Mm.
So he ended up sort of writing three tracks together and decided to give a Let's Throw a Party, Free Beer. And then they ended up sort of getting donations for subsequent gigs. I think after their third gig, they got a name check on XFM, which is a local radio station in Manchester. And then they became these really sought-after gigs, you know. So people like Rick Rubin and producers were wanting to go because there was a scene.
Is that right, Rick Rubin?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. So it was just really odd that you've got this scene, and literally it was round the corner. I mean, when I got my house, you couldn't get a mortgage because, no, it was that rough. So it was really, you know, you'd get followed by people in hoodies from the... I didn't go to the shop at night, put it that way.
Blimey.
It was very rough around there. If you walked into town, it was better, but I never went anywhere on my own. I mean, now it's completely changed. It's completely gentrified, and it's just spread up, and there's a lot of change. But so what I love about the Ting Tings for me is that I can see they got this edge, and I know they were part of it. And you know what? I was so happy for them because their first album, this album for me, did it. I just loved their...
Well, they didn't really do anything else after
that. Well, no, that's... I think they had this thing, and their single before That's Not My Name was really like really cool, and that went to number one. And they did a load of festivals and stuff when on the road, but I think they took themselves off, and I don't know whether it was Berlin or somewhere I remember reading, to do the next album. And I think they went underground and went maybe too inside themselves, and they're still doing stuff, but they had their ride on that wave, I think.
I think the thing is with a short-term band like that, there's nothing wrong with a short-term project, you know, where you get, it's like David Bowie, you know, and Tin Machine.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't slated by the critics, but he did it because he wanted to be part of a band. He didn't want to be a star anymore. He wanted to be part of a rock and roll band, you know?
Yeah.
And these short-term things sometimes really work. I mean, the thing about the guitar on this one, it always makes me laugh every time I hear it. It's Nile Rodgers.
Nile Rodgers.
I actually
got up and danced when he started playing, yeah.
It's not as funky, but it's quite basic, you know, in terms of its thing. But you can hear that Nile Rodgers is all over it, you know. And then you hear there's a lot of electronic stuff in there as well. But it's a good song. It's a very happy song. And it does really bring us back to our roots in Manchester, doesn't it?
It does. Kick ass.
Psychedelic invocations, I met a hurry at the station, I give to you a job, a princess of Hindu birth, a woman of flesh, a child of the earth, give to you. Well, the handguns of Babylon, Miles Davis, the black unicorn, I give to you.
of Montezuma, the gardens of Akbar's tomb, I give to you. The spider goddess and needle boy, the slave dwarves that they employ, I give to you. A custard colored super dream of Ollie McGraw and Steve McQueen, I give to you. Come on, baby, let's get out of the cold. Give me, your precious love for me to hold. The epic of Gilgamesh, a pretty little black A-line dress, I give to you. The spinal cord of JFK wrapped in Marilyn Monroe's negligee, I give to you. I want nothing in return, just the softest little breathless word I ask of you. A word contained in a grain of sand that can barely walk, can't even stand, I ask for you. Come on, baby, let's get out of the cold. Give me your precious love for me to hold. Come on, baby, come out of the cold. Oh, yeah. And give me your precious love.
You're listening to The Supertone Show with Susie Starlight. That's me and Simon Campbell. That's him from the Starlight Campbell Band.
Yes, indeed. And that was Grinderman, Palaces of Montezuma. The eighth track and third single from the band's second and final studio album, Grinderman 2, which was released on the 14th of March 2011 on the very wonderful and eclectic Mute Records.
So it's not Grinderman then?
No. Well, Grinderman, the band was named after Grinderman Blues by Memphis Slim.
Really? You know that? No, yeah. I did not know that.
Ah, no, I just dug that one out, didn't I?
Get ha-ha. You.
Ha-ha.
Okay.
And also, it was recorded
2 points.
At Rack Studios, which is Mickey Moe's studios that he set up absolutely years ago. It's in this Bible book that I've got about British recording, a fantastic studio. And the interesting thing about that is that it's recorded through an API console and I can hear it because it's got that crunch that only an API has. And I know it's sort of a really funny thing to say, but I just picked it up then when I was listening to it. There's a crunch to the bass. There's something about the sound which is very API. API is a huge manufacturer of analog recording consoles. Mm. And probably one of only two companies that are really doing great analog consoles anymore, Neve, the Rupert Neve series, and API. So there we are. Mm.
So it's like, though, if you were a wine connoisseur, you would know a certain region or a certain taste or a certain grape, I would say, actually. And I think that's the same with sound. You get to know after a while, don't you? Because that's what your job is. That's what you do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and yesterday I was watching something on YouTube. I just happened to come across it. And it was talking about, it was this recording studio in Nashville, Tennessee, that now have thrown away basically their analog console and they're mixing in the box, which from a technical point of view is what they're doing. They're actually mixing it in the computer rather than actually using a big console to do it. Yeah. So it's all done digitally.
And when you say mixing, it basically is the levels between the drums and it's getting all the levels right, isn't it? And mixing all the instruments together to be one cohesive
and changing
sound.
Changing the tone of things and adding effects and stuff. Yeah, no, that's what I mean by mixing and compression and all those things to make it sound like a record, make it sound cohesive. But, you know, I still believe, and we always have this argument, that actually mixing it on a real live console is the best way of doing it. And the only reason why this guy has moved away from mixing in a big console live to actually doing it, let's not in the box, is he said it's recall, because more and more people are coming back asking to change mixes.
Yeah.
Now, it never used to be like that, because in the original days, with, you know, when we listened to David Bowie earlier on, all these tracks that we've heard today, they were mixed in a morning. There were, you know, like Ken Scott, when he was doing a David Bowie record, it'd take 3 weeks.
Fade up, tweak, and he'd do by feel. You can see it, because that's what we do. You do it, and you just go, right, okay, that's fine. You listen to it, eyes closed, okay. Let's run that and see how it goes.
The question is, to me, is that is music any better now than it was in 1970? Answer, no. Does the music sound any better? Is the production any better? Is the actual sound of the instruments any better? You know, no. You know why? Because people are trying to get it too perfect.
Yeah.
It's too perfect, and you can't have perfection. Even a masterful performance of an orchestral piece with a world-class orchestra, right, there will be cock-ups somewhere, there'll be squeaks, there'll be bangs, there'll be something happening in that recording somewhere.
It's like, it's not satisfying my soul, it's like sterilise my soul,
isn't
it, really?
Holy, you know, I've just had enough of it. I'm sick to death of modern sanitised music. It sounds like somebody's poured a whole load of bleach over it and just, or boiled it up in a pan and said,
exactly.
Right, we'll boil, that's it. Anyway, right, off my high horse here, but there we are, back to Nick Cave.
Well, do you know what, I love, and in fact, that song, that track wasn't long enough for me. I want to play it again.
Yeah.
Because it was just evoked a beautiful feel. I really like, I need to know more about Nick Cave. I want to listen to more of his stuff. And this was interesting, but you know, it's the end of the show now.
No.
Yeah, I got in there. Oh, I know, I'm just watching the clock now.
Okay.
So look, thank you so much for joining us for this week. And you can get hold of us on the usual social media outlets, all those kind of places like Instagram.
Yeah, if you look at the Supertone Show or Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell, you'll find us everywhere.
Yeah. So we're going to play you out with this final track by a band you'll know called Jethro Tull. And it's called Locomotive Breath, and it's from their fourth studio album, Aqualung. And it was released in 1971 on Chrysalis and Island Records in Europe and the Reprise label in the USA, Japan and Oceania.
Blimey.
Yeah, I know. It's a mouthful.
And Jethro Tull, talking of this, just have a listen to this track and just talk to me about the sound, because this, I think this was done with a Kadak console. We love Kadak. And again, they have a very distinctive sound. Absolutely wonderful. Really, really, what's the word? It's rich and thick. And, you know, Jethro Tull, a marvellous band which have really defined description, really, because they're such a folk rock, hopping around on one leg with a flute. I don't know. But Jethro Tull are very Jethro Tull, that's all I can say.
But it's quite interesting about this song, because it was recorded quite differently, because Ian Anderson couldn't quite explain what he wanted, so they kind of all recorded their parts separately. And then they overdubbed. It started. See you next week.
Thank you. all-time loser. Headlong to his death. Oh, it feels a piston scraping, steam breaking on his brow. His children jumping off the stations one by one. His woman and his best friend in bed and having fun. Oh, he's calling down the corridor on his hands and knees. Time winner has got him by the balls.